Okay, the first thing I wanted to talk about a little bit is the midterms. You know, you have a midterm on Monday. Be sure you bring a blue book and go back over the syllabus to see how the exams are described there. This is how you should prepare for the exam. You should try and figure out what the questions pretty much have to be, right? Well, what does my goal have to be in the midterms? I want to test the degree to which you've absorbed the main points that have been developed in the course. I want to make sure that you grasp the basic factual content that we've covered in the course. So it'll be, you should understand what the concert of Europe was, what the system was that was established at the Congress of Vienna, what the difference was between the kind of character of international politics in the first half of the 19th century, what it was afterwards. And what's the difference between Metternich and Bismarck in terms of their core approaches to foreign policy? What are the main events? What are the main points to be made about the origins of the Crimean War? Those kinds of things, right? And about the readings, not the textbooks, not the Rich and the Sontag textbooks, but all those other readings that you did, the Cassirer State paper and that Salisbury article about the terms of peace. You want to be, things like that. You want to be able to talk about what the heart of the argument was in those things. What the meaning of those documents is. So, and the best way to prepare, I think, is to get together with other people in the class and have like a little study group and just ask yourself, try and come up with the questions in effect. Ask yourself, what's likely to be on the exam and then just try and answer those questions. And I say, the basic factual material, it's not like the details of some obscure treaty between Russia and Turkey or where the Sanjak of Novi Bazar is located. I'm not going to ask you things of that order of detail, but the main events you should be able to put in chronological order. If you think that the Crimean War came before the Congress of Vienna, well, then I know that you have real problems with the material that's covered in the class. Things like that. You should be able to, who was on each side during the Crimean War, that sort of thing. Really basic stuff. Great events leading to the unification of Germany, that kind of thing. Any of you have questions about the exam? It should be fairly straightforward, yeah?
What's the format?
Just short answer questions, not an essay, but the kind, like a lot of factual things that either you know it or you don't. Like questions about the readings, what's the point of such reading? Or, these basic questions designed to test your command, the basic factual side of the test. So it's kind of very direct. It shouldn't be any surprises if you've been, coming to lecture and doing the readings and taking the class seriously. You shouldn't have any problem with this exam. It's like, look at it this way. The questions are not going to be so easy that you would be able to answer them even if you hadn't taken the class. On the other hand, they're not going to be tricky or detailed. And if you made an honest effort in the class, you shouldn't have any trouble. Any other questions about the exams? All right. Today I'm going to be talking about the whole Gladstone phenomenon, which is very important for our purposes. Because what Gladstone stood for was a certain approach to the conduct of foreign policy. That was actually quite important. Gladstone was Woodrow Wilson's great hero. This is kind of the beginning of a certain tradition in the whole world of international politics. A whole body of ideas about how foreign policy should be conducted. See it again in the 20th century with Woodrow Wilson, Jimmy Carter in the United States. In fact, it continues to the present day. A liberal approach to foreign policy. And why is this important? Because it's a major alternative to the sort of approach that Bismarck stood for. You know, and it carries over also to the world of international relations theory. It's as though the world of theory is divided into these two great gangs. When I was about your age, I was over in England, and all of British youth was kind of divided into these kind of two great gangs, so it seemed, the mods and the rockers. And I don't know if you ever saw this movie, Hard Day's Night, and they ask Ringo Starr in the movie, are you a mod or a rocker? And he says, I'm a mocker. So I thought, like, well, you know, that pretty much sums up my whole personality. But the world of international relations theory is also divided up into these two great gangs, kind of, the realists and the liberals. And it's a normative issue. It's not just an issue of how does international politics work. It's the issue of how it should work. What sort of principles should guide foreign policy? A lot of people don't like the sort of approach that Bismarck stood for, the realist approach, Realpolitik, to use the German term. We talk a lot about the Bismarck policy, you know, rooted in Germany's fundamental geopolitical problem, Bismarck's geopolitical problem. I talk about this a lot. What is that problem? It derives from the decision to take on Alsace-Lorraine and the consequent tension that you would have between France and Germany. Europe of five great powers, the key thing was to be one of three. You can't have an alignment that included France. So what sorts of alignments were available for Germany? Well, there was the alignment of the three Eastern empires, and there's the anti-Russian alignment. They were alignment based on the containment of Russian power in conjunction with Britain, Germany, Austria versus Germany, Austria, Russia. And what was the Bismarck solution to this problem? In a sense, given the basis of the problem, this was an optimal solution. He refused to, you know, opt clearly for one or the other of those two alignments, and instead he tried to balance between the two. In other words, keep both of those possible alignments open, keep elements of each in place. And why is this kind of optimal? As opposed to just siding very clearly, say, for a policy based on the containment of Russia, a policy based on this alignment with England and Austria? Well, part of it is you don't totally trust the British to cooperate. And given your geographical position, if you get into hot water, your neck is going to be on the chopping block. The British are going to be relatively secure, you know, behind their naval defenses, right? So you're not comfortable with either of these two, because in effect you become too dependent on the policies of other countries. That is not a comfortable position. And these other countries can in fact threaten to defect. They can threaten to go over to the side of France. And you can't meet that threat with a countervailing threat of your own to go over to the side of France, because France isn't interested in anything like that. But it's not just that that makes this kind of an optimal sort of relationship, keeping both alignment possibilities open. It's like, if they're both open, all of your alignment partners have something to hope for and something to fear. They can hope that you will help them and that you will support them, and they have something to fear that they may lose you because you can't easily tilt in the opposite direction because that path is also open for you. And that gives you the maximum amount of leverage. It gives you it's a way of maximizing your freedom of action, your control over the situation, your ability to influence other powers' policies and thus to provide for your own security. Right? But it's a balancing act. It's a juggling act. He has to kind of keep all these different balls in the air at the same time. This is a system that puts an enormous premium on diplomatic skill, on maneuver, and in fact, as I was saying, in fact, also on duplicity. A certain element of duplicity is built into the very structure of this kind of system, because you have to tell everybody slightly different things because you're always manipulating everybody. Not terribly stable system. This is not a rock solid system. Not like it's headed toward war, but it's very unclear whether these arrangements can be kept intact. You know, how long are the other powers willing to kind of be manipulated? Play this kind of game. Right? So, and the striking thing about all of this is that Germany, after 1871, is a status quo power. Germany is a satiated power. Bismarck doesn't want any more territory. Right? But the fact that the most important power in Europe is committed to the maintenance of the status quo is by no means a guarantee that you're going to have a stable peace. And simply by being interested in the maintenance of the status quo doesn't automatically mean that you don't care what goes on outside your borders. That because the only thing you're worried about is defending yourself against attack, because you don't have to worry about taking action outside of your borders to support an aggressive policy of your own. You're happy with the status quo, but that's not sufficient to provide for stability. Because of the basic structure of the system, you're drawn into a concern with the constellation of power, with the whole question of what other countries are going to do, how they're aligned with each other, and so on. You have to worry about these things simply by virtue of your geographical position. And the fact that your power is not unlimited. Germany might be the number one power, but Germany is by no means a hegemon here. And Germany has to worry about the other powers kind of ganging up against her, or one or the other of them becoming too strong. So, all right. And so you look at this system and say, well, Bismarck was a master. This is the best that he could do. But you have to wonder whether there are alternatives, whether there's an alternative to realpolitik, whether you can have an entirely different approach to foreign policy that would result in a much better world, a more peaceful world, a more stable world. And this great liberal dream, yeah. We don't have to play the game of power politics. The game of power politics is somewhat sordid. It doesn't really put the peace on an absolutely stable basis. Maybe we could reach for something different. An important strain in foreign policy thinking, especially in a country like the United States. And one of your goals in a class like this is to try and assess these different approaches to foreign policy. Right? People who make that argument, the alternatives to realpolitik are much better. People who argue, for a more liberal approach to foreign policy, are they right? In a sense, your heart pulls you in that direction. But you can't make these decisions with your heart. You have to make these decisions with your brain. Are they right? Well, how do you get a handle on that question of, are they right? Well, you look at what happens in practice. you look at what happens when these liberal policies come to dominate the political behavior of a great state, like Woodrow Wilson, Jimmy Carter, and in the case today, William Gladstone, the Gladstone policy. So what was the Gladstone policy, right? Very clearly, this was to be an alternative, a fundamentally different approach to the conduct of foreign policy. Gladstone had been a major political figure in the mid-19th century, going back to the year of Palmerston. And he had been prime minister of a liberal government that had been in power at the time of the Franco-Prussian War in 1870-1871. Following the defeat of the liberal government in the mid-1870s, he went into retirement, but was pulled back out of retirement by the Eastern Crisis, and especially the 1876 phase of the Eastern Crisis, which was the phase dominated by what the Turks were doing in what's now Bulgaria, crushing the Bulgarian insurrection. And Gladstone gave these speeches, wrote a very famous pamphlet about what he called the Bulgarian horrors. And this is important because this is this strain of liberal humanitarianism which is now coming into its own. You saw a little bit of it in the early 19th century with the interest in Greece especially, but now it's a major political force in Britain, not on the continent. And as an election in 1879, right? Don't forget the Eastern Crisis is resolved in 1877-78. The resolutions confirmed by a Congress of the Great Powers, the Congress of Berlin of 1878. Talked about the various aspects of this settlement. Not a big Bulgaria, not the sort of thing that was provided in the Treaty of San Stefano, but a smaller Bulgarian state. Actually, it was divided into two parts. Various other provisions, the occupation of Bosnia by Austria-Hungary, annexation of Bessarabia by Russia, and the British also got a share. They were allowed to occupy the island of Cyprus there in the very eastern Mediterranean. And this was supposed to be a base for British naval power. Plus also, the British were supposed to set up a model government in Cyprus as a kind of demonstration to the Turks about how they could reform. And the British were supposed to be responsible for the reform of Turkey. Cyprus Convention. The all these things were attacked in very unrestrained language by Gladstone during the 1879 election campaign. Condemned the whole Cyprus Convention. He says, by which the British had undertaken to defend Turkey and Asia, alone and single-handed, and to be responsible for the good government of perhaps the worst governed country in the world. For this, there was but one epithet, an insane convention. Britain, he said, had been kept in hot water since San Stefano, because we insisted that no part of it could be valid without the consent of Europe. And consequently that it must be brought before the powers. Yet at the same moment, we were framing a secret engagement with Turkey, an act of duplicity not surpassed and rarely equaled in the history of nations. This was a tough language. Disraeli had been responsible, prime minister during that period. He referred to Gladstone as a sophistical rhetorician, inebriated with the exuberance of his own verbosity. Now, that's the level of political discourse among these two great statesmen of Victorian England. But what Gladstone did during this campaign, went beyond simply criticizing the policy that the Israeli government had pursued during the Eastern Crisis. He laid out an alternative. And the alternative was laid out most clearly in a famous speech that he gave in his own parliamentary constituency, the constituency of Midlothian and Scotland. And so this was called the Midlothian Program, right? It's important to kind of get a sense for the thinking that lay behind Gladstone's foreign policy. He laid it out in these six principles of the Midlothian Program, very similar to Woodrow Wilson's 14 points or the 8 points of the Atlantic Charter or whatever. We have these things a lot. But these six principles of the Midlothian Program. What did it call for? The first principle, to foster the strength of the empire and to reserve it for great and worthy occasions, right? And how do you do that? Through just legislation and economy at home, thereby producing two great elements of national power, namely wealth, which is a physical element, and union and contentment, which are moral elements. Notice the absence of military power. The second point, again, it has this kind of semi-pacifist flavor. To preserve to the nations the blessings of peace, and then is a little twist of it, especially word but for shame when we recollect the sacred name we bear as Christians for the Christian nations. And the third is to cultivate to the utmost the concert of Europe, because you thus neutralize and fetter the selfish aims of each, and because common action alone can unite the great powers for the common good. In other words, you don't have to play the game of power politics. You don't think of international politics as inherently conflictual. People should cooperate with each other, right? The concert of Europe is the key to solving the whole problem of how you could put international politics on a relatively stable basis. Everyone should work together, right? Thinking of the use of your power against other countries, or you're not taking international conflict as a normal part of international political life. And the fourth one is to avoid needless and entangling engagements, which he says only reduce the power of the empire. You see, the whole of those first four points, the whole flavor is, we don't want to use force. Semi-pacifistic, semi-isolationist. Instead of international politics as a politics of power, we replace that with kind of what Woodrow Wilson was to call a community of power. The concert of Europe, the countries acting together, not against each other, not balancing each other. Right? Very characteristic of this sort of philosophy. Right? Here's the problem. It was linked with the whole other side of liberal policy, was that you should stand up for moral principle, for ideology, right? And so in point five, he talks about how you have to acknowledge the rights of all nations. You must sympathize with one nation more than another, and as a rule, with those most closely linked by language, blood, religion, or other circumstance of the time. But in point of right, all are equal, and you have no right to set up a system under which one is to be placed under moral suspicion or espionage or made the subject of constant invective. If you do that, and especially if you claim for yourself a pharisaical superiority, you may talk about your patriotism as you please, but you are a misjudging friend of your country and are undermining the basis of esteem and respect of others for it. Acknowledge the rights of all nations. And point six, foreign policy should always be inspired by love of freedom, a desire to give it scope, founded not on visionary ideas, but upon the long experience of many generations within the shores of this happy isle. In freedom, you lay the firmest foundation both of loyalty and of order for the development of individual character and the best protection for the happiness of the nation at large. Right? You want to stand for moral principle. Right? You want to stand for the principle of freedom, for the extension of freedom, for the rights of all nations, the sovereign equality of all states. Is this a coherent philosophy? You want the concert of Europe. How are you going to have the concert of Europe? Are the other countries in Europe going to support the same sort of policy? Are they also going to stand up for the rights of all nations? For the principle of freedom? Well, not every country in Europe is a liberal country, the way Victorian England. Even that, only half liberal. Russia's going to buy into this? Austria-Hungary is going to buy into this? The rights of all nations, doesn't that kind of imply the collapse of the Ottoman Empire? Doesn't it ultimately really imply the collapse of the Austrian Empire? All these multinational empires? These countries are going to cooperate with you with this? If you buy into this sort of philosophy, doesn't that mean you're accepting conflict with these other countries? But if you accept conflict with these countries, don't you have to worry about power? If you believe in the concert of Europe, don't you have to kind of relate to these countries on a power political basis, putting your ideological preferences to the side? Because otherwise, how can you cooperate with them? Because they don't share your ideas. Right? This is a very fundamental conflict. Which way are you going to go? Non-use of force or a very active policy aimed at the promotion of freedom and self-determination of glory? Right? You go that if you want to extend freedom, doesn't that mean you have to kind of take on other countries? Doesn't mean you have to use force? But then why aren't you talking about the use of force? Why aren't you talking about interventionism? You say, oh no, we don't want to intervene. We want to kind of have a low-key policy, right? So on that kind of fundamental, conceptual level, you find this core contradiction in the Gladstonian approach. Well, you may say, oh well, that's just abstract words. When it comes to practical politics, you know, people could solve those kinds of problems. They can work these things out. They could strike the right balance so that you support the principle of the concert of Europe, but also you try and encourage the spread of liberty throughout the world. No? Can you do it? The only way to answer that question is to look at what was actually going on. When Gladstone came to power, as he tried to put this policy into effect, was he able to square the circle in practice? What he tried to shifted away from the old conservative policy of trying to prop up the Ottoman Empire in southeastern Europe. And Britain threw her weight into the balance on behalf of the subject nationalities, the Christian populations of southeastern Europe. The effect of this was to alienate Austria. So Austria wanted to maintain the integrity of the Ottoman Empire for fear of seeing it fall apart, and seeing Russian power, you know, penetrate down into that area and exercise a corrosive effect on the integrity of the Habsburg monarchy itself. But it wasn't just Austria, the weakest of the great powers, that was affected. It was Germany as well. And why should Germany be affected? Because Germany wants to maintain the status quo. The maintenance of the status quo means, ultimately, the containment of Russia. That was the meaning of the Romania Alliance. We talked about that. Iron barrier across the path of expansion of Russia. Right? But you don't want to have to practice an overt anti-Russian policy, above all, without the support of the British. You don't want to have to show your hand directly. You would much prefer the British to kind of carry the ball in terms of the containment of Russian expansionism. So that the Britain and Austria could do the trick together, you could hold back and tell the Russians, oh, we're basically friends of yours. We're certainly not enemies. We're neutral in all of this. Because you wanted to allow Russia to go on hoping that she can get something from good relations with you and avoid Russia defecting over to the side of France. So the Germans don't like this one bit. As a matter of fact, Bismarck hates Gladstone, Professor Gladstone. A term of utter contempt. Concert of Europe, when you're pursuing policies that basically drive away two of the most important countries in Europe. Bit of a problem. But that was just the beginning. 1879, 1880. The real test of the Gladstone policy. Gladstone is now prime minister again. In a liberal government that was swept into office in those 1879 elections. Gladstone, the real test of the Gladstone policy has to do with Egypt. This is the policy that led to the British occupation of Egypt in 1882. It's supposed to be a temporary occupation, but it lasted until well after World War II. Okay? British occupation of Egypt. You recall this sixth point about British policy should be inspired by the love of liberty. Fifth point, you should acknowledge the rights of all nations. The puzzle here, isn't it? How was it that this British policy, averse to imperialist expansion, supposedly sympathized with the aspirations of self-determination and so on, people, you know, not just in Europe, but everywhere. How was it the British, moved into Egypt, conquered Egypt, occupied Egypt. Under Gladstone, it's leading anti-imperialist. What does this tell us about this issue? Does it mean that the whole line of policy laid out in the Midlothian speech was just a sham? Well, what's the story with Egypt? Egyptian story is quite interesting because this is the beginning of what was to be a very important historical phenomenon, a third world nationalism. We talked about how the course of economic development in the 19th century resulted in this dramatic shift in the distribution of power between Europe and the rest of the world. When you look at those figures for industrial production, you see the European countries just moving ahead by leaps and bounds in comparison with the rest of the world. And that power disparity, had its consequences in terms of relations between Europe and what we ultimately came to call the third world. But in parts of the third world, local rulers were quite aware of what was going on and thought that the key to maintaining power, not being totally at the mercy of the Europeans, was by developing their own country's economy. Egypt was in the forefront of this quite early on in the 1830s and so on. But to do this, they needed money. And they borrowed money from the Europeans. And they brought in European firms, European experts, and so on. This cost a lot of money. And how are they going to pay these loans back? In the 19th century, especially mid-19th century, the balance of power was such that these countries couldn't simply walk away from those loans. They couldn't simply repudiate those loans. And if they tried to do that, there would be, military interventions to impose a kind of financial control. You see this in the Ottoman Empire, you see this in China, for example, and above all, you see it in Egypt. The Egyptian ruler, the Caliph of Egypt, Egypt was semi-independent within the Ottoman Empire, had tried to develop his own country, had gotten into debt. He tried to reduce the debt by selling his shares in the Suez Canal in 1875, but this wasn't enough to do the trick. And an Anglo-French financial control was imposed. And the effect of the control was to really squeeze the desperately poor Egyptian peasantry. Plus, it affected the interests of the Egyptian ruling classes in a kind of major way. And the harshness of the control, backed up ultimately by Anglo-French military power, led to a nationalist movement within Egypt in the late 1870s, early 1880s. The key figure here was an army officer named Arabi. So this is also often called the Arabi movement, sometimes the Arabi revolt. How would the Europeans, especially the British, deal with this? And it's important to note that Gladstone's first instinct was to sympathize with it. You know, he was perplexed by it. Europeans had never seen this kind of thing before. Nationalism was an essentially European phenomenon. And all these ideas of the French Revolution, they had been moving east. They had not really touched what we think of as the Third World. So they're perplexed. But fundamentally, Gladstone is sympathetic. This is from a letter that he wrote to the Foreign Secretary, Lord Granville. You know, you can just feel how confused he is by this phenomenon. "I'm not by any means pained, but I am much surprised at this rapid development of a national sentiment and party in Egypt. The very ideas of such a sentiment in the Egyptian people seemed quite incompatible. How it's come out, I don't know. Most of all is the case strange of the standing army with the nest that has reared it. There, however, it seems to be, and to claim the respect due to it as a fact, and due also to the capabilities that may be latent in it for the future. Egypt for the Egyptians is the sentiment to which I should wish to give scope, and could it prevail, it would, I think, be the best, the only solution of the Egyptian question." This is early 1882. Sympathetic with it. Yet later in 1882, the British send in troops to kind of basically destroy the Egyptian national movement. How is this possible? It's not only, if you're interested in this stuff, there's a terrific book called Africa and the Victorians by Robinson and Gallagher. And they have a chapter that goes into this stuff in very great detail on the basis of the British archival evidence. And the interesting thing is, it was Gladstone's commitment to the concert of Europe, and in particular to cooperation with the other liberal power in Europe, France, the French Third Republic, that drove Gladstone in, that pushed on the British government. The French also had a strong interest in Egypt, going back to Napoleonic times. And they actually took a tougher line than the British in terms of dealing with the nationalist movement, refusing to kind of make real compromises on the whole issue of the debt and the Anglo-French financial control. And in fact, threatening to use force I mean, it's a little ironic. One of the great champions of that hardline policy in France was the foreign minister in the beginning of 1882. His name was Gambetta. And we saw him before, Gambetta, at the time of the Franco-Prussian War. Great champion of French nationalism, the rights of French people, all this talk about how awful it was that the Germans were taking over this French territory and so on. Oh yeah, well, you can speak from the heart when it's a question of the rights of the French, but when it's a question of the rights of the Egyptian, very, very different line. This was, you can't give him an inch. So what are the British to do? Just stand aside and allow the French to move in? They didn't want a major power to dominate areas as important strategically as Egypt, because the Suez Canal is what connects the Mediterranean, Europe as a whole, with India, which is Britain's prized imperial possession. So it's kind of fundamental strategic importance for the British. Plus, there was a sense of you couldn't just walk away from the Anglo-French financial control. You couldn't just wash your hands of this. You know, countries had to, you know, be made to accept responsibility for their actions. You know, they had gotten the money. They would have to pay for it. It's a very different philosophy of international debt in those days than it was to be the case in the 20th century. And then once the French moved into Egypt, what was that going to do to the rest of the Ottoman Empire? You're walking away from a policy trying to prevent the partition of the Ottoman Empire. Could you do that? Worry about Russia and so on. And so what the British did was they said, well, we have to work with Europe, concert of Europe. We have to work in particular with France, the other interested power here. The French want to kind of maintain the Anglo-French control regime. You know, we don't want to actually do it, but the way to pull this thing off, the way to deal with all these problems without having an actual armed intervention, above all a French armed intervention, is to align ourselves with the French on behalf of this tough policy so as to intimidate the Egyptians. You know, they can't stand up to Europe as a whole. They can't stand up to Britain and France if they act as a whole. They'll understand that. They'll be intimidated. They'll reach an understanding with us. So we have to align ourselves with the French. And so in pursuit of that policy, the British allow themselves to be drawn in. But with every step that the British and French take in terms of making these threats to Egypt, sending the British and French fleets to Alexandria and so on, this simply inflames the Egyptians. Right? The efforts of the Europeans to impose their control over Egypt become more and more overt, more and more outrageous, and the Arabi movement becomes more and more powerful. It becomes kind of linked up with acts of violence against the Europeans in Egypt, and Christian populations in Egypt. There were riots in Alexandria, for example. What are you going to do? The French seem to want to take a tough line. They can't disengage from that. And finally, the issue kind of comes to a head. It seems like it's a question of now or never. You have to act. Egyptians are building up their own defenses. It seems like all kinds of, you know, changes are going to take place in Egypt that are viewed as utterly unacceptable, even by people like Gladstone. Chaos in the country, you know, persecution of the Christian population there. It's too late to not do anything, to just stand aside. And the French now say they don't want to come in. And so the British go in alone, thinking this is just going to be a temporary occupation, 1882. here. The effective rule is, it ends the Anglo-French Entente. Britain and France had had this kind of liberal alignment for years. Which, by the way, not unwelcome to Bismarck. Bismarck did not think that France's alignment with Britain was a bad thing. For one thing, it meant that France might be part of a coalition to contain Russia without Germany's active support. Another thing was, if France split away from Britain, France would be more likely to align herself with Russia, which was Britain's traditional adversary, the entire rim of Asia. Okay. Egypt destroys the Anglo-French Entente for this period. Egypt drives those two powers apart. Very, very important to her consequence. This also means that Bismarck now has a chance to take action to bring down Gladstone. Okay? Gladstone's policy, supposedly built on the whole notion of the concert of Europe, acting together with other countries in Europe, it alienated Austria, therefore it alienated Germany. Now it alienated France. Bismarck says, we can make kind of a temporary marriage of convenience with France over colonial issues, really squeeze the British on colonial issues. So this is when Germany makes her bid for colonies, Germany's first bid for colonies, 1884, in conjunction with the French. There was a kind of alignment between Bismarck and the French government of that day, headed by Jules Ferry, focusing on African issues and having a distinct anti-British edge to it, right? And by putting forth Germany's African claims. It wasn't as though Bismarck particularly cared about the African colonies. He said, you want to know my map of Africa? And he points to the map of Europe. He says, there's my map of Africa. That's the Bismarck approach. But the Bismarck policy was to bring down Gladstone. And in the words of Bismarck's own son, he says, the policy was to squash Gladstone against the wall, to ride the English deeper into the mire so that his prestige will vanish even among the masses of the stupid English electorate. Right? So Gladstone, in pursuit of the policy of the concert of Europe, had alienated Austria, alienated Germany, alienated France. Well, maybe objectively, the policy should have brought him closer to Russia, but the Russians didn't trust him either. They said, this is not serious policy. It's a flaming meteor that it'll burn itself out in no time at all. And in fact, the Russians saw their chance resulting from Britain's isolation from all the other continental countries. So the Russians were now encouraged to move against the British because the British were so weak and isolated. So the Russians move ahead in Central Asia, and this is the Pangaea incident in 1885, which again brings Russia and Britain to the brink of an armed conflict. Okay? But Salisbury looks at all this stuff, his comment is, well, Gladstone's achieved his beloved concert of Europe, all right. He's united all of Europe against England. Right? It's like 1885, the Gladstone policy, it crashes. Crashes. And you can't help but think that it's not an accident. That there are these fundamental conceptual problems with a policy of that sort. And we'll see it again when we look at the Wilson experience during the First World War. And we'll see it again in 138B when we look at some aspects of American policy during, like, Jimmy Carter period and so on. You'd like to believe that this is a viable alternative. You'd like to believe that an ideological policy is the way to go, extending democracy, extending freedom. But when you look at what happens when such policies are put into effect, you really have to wonder. When you see see these things happening over and over again, you have to wonder whether that really is the solution to this kind of core geopolitical problem that, countries have to face. You can't be oblivious to power political realities. You have to worry about your relations with all the other major powers in the system. You have an interest in good relations with as many countries as possible, an interest in having as few enemies as possible. Right? That's a power political interest. But to pursue that interest, can you really afford to pursue a policy based on ideological considerations which run counter to those power political interests? That's one of the most important lessons to draw from the study of the whole Gladstone experience in the early 1880s. Okay, next time, the climax of the Bismarckian system in the late 1880s.